members.
Good one, the NCLP.
I'm going to call this Education Policy Committee to order. I didn't mean to make anybody run. We're going to just chat for a minute anyway. So this is going to be our last meeting for this session, I think. I'm pretty sure. And I just wanted, I know I did my thank yous when we put together the policy bill, but I just wanted to thank the committee again for all their hard work and all the thoughtfulness and the great questions and the respect and the collegiality. And so I baked cookies this weekend, so I'll be passing it around. The Ranger cookies have nuts in them in case anybody's allergic. So one of my grandmother's recipe and my other grandmother's recipe is the molasses cookies. So we'll start those on either end, one on each, and just a little way of just saying thank you. And I know we're going to all be spending some much quality time on the floor together soon, but really have appreciated being in committee with you guys. And can we have another round of applause for our amazing staff, both pages, partisan staff, and nonpartisan staff. All right, so as those are getting around, today I want us to just kick off this discussion and lay the table for some issues we might be facing or wanting to deal with next year. And I shouldn't say issues, I should say opportunities. So this is a way to look at opportunities for next year. And we put a quick agenda together where we're going to have the Department of Human Rights talk for the first 20 minutes on what they've been doing around suspensions and the work they've been doing with school districts, and then 10 minutes for questions after that. Then we're going to move on, and we're going to have three different school districts come up and talk about some of the work that they've been doing to reduce suspensions. Another 10-minute question, time for questioning, and then another 20 minutes we have PACER, Solutions Not Suspension, and Ed Allies brought some parents together to talk to us as well. And there may or may not be, looking at the time, probably not be, like 10 minutes at the very end for any more testimony in the audience. But when we posted this, we asked for written testimony if we didn't have time to open it up at the end. I am hoping to keep this all very respectful and bringing all this to us and our committee in good spirit. So with that, we have Commissioner Rebecca Lucero at the table. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and Mr. Scott Patel, and we will continue.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay? Wonderful. Okay, great. So yes, my name is Rebecca Lucero, and I'm the new commissioner of the Human Rights Department. I'm really honored to be here talking to you about this today.
And I am Scott Butel. I am the assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights.
Thank you.
And so we'll just get started. And actually, since I am new appearing before this committee, I just wanted to start real quick by sharing a little bit of information about myself. So I was born and raised in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I fell in love with the Midwest through my undergraduate years in the Midwest in Iowa at Grinnell College. And so for those of you who know and love Grinnell, yes. I moved to Minnesota in 2004 for law school. And I've been here ever since, and I have deeply fallen in love with this community and made this my home and my family here. The work that I've done here over time, I've worked for government, for-profit, and nonprofit organizations. Most recently, I was at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. Before that, at Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. And I have a real legal background doing plaintiff-side employment law, working at legal aid as well. And so it's really kind of bringing everything together to be here with you folks today, and I'm enjoying every single day that we've been here. So let's talk a little bit about the work of the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. So the work of the department is to really make sure that we're creating a world where people lead full lives, full of joy and dignity. And I just want to stress at the front that that includes students. We do this work every day through the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and we've been doing this for over 50 years. So it's deeply built into the work that we do, and I really want to highlight that it supports every person in every county of Minnesota. It's a real critical time to be doing this work, particularly Minnesota has some of the highest racial disparities in the entire country, and that's across the board in employment, education, criminal justice system. Today we'll be specifically talking about some of those disparities as it relates to education. And so that's why this is such an important time to be doing this work right now. I'd like to highlight the five ways that our agency works to create a thriving Minnesota. So the first way is we partner with businesses to meet and exceed hiring goals. And I'll just mention one really great example of that because it's right across the street from us here, the Minnesota State Capital Restoration Project. And that project had 35% people of color with the workforce participation levels and 21% for women. That's the highest workforce participation levels for women for a construction project in Minnesota history ever. And so we know when we partner with businesses on the front end to be really thoughtful about these rapidly changing demographics across the state, we see real results like that. The second is we work to identify patterns and practices for education and outreach. I hope you know that we have an office in St. Cloud. We work on the ground there to meet with people. And a perfect example of this is when we were able to see a lot of charges coming in the door with concerns about discrimination with landlord and tenant situations. And our team on the ground in St. Cloud quickly met with the landlords and said, hey, let's talk about what the law is, and let's come up with some let's look at your policies and procedures and make sure we're solving these issues before they even come to this place of perceived or actual discrimination. Third, and this is what we're the best known for, is investigating individual charges of discrimination. I'm not going to talk about that today, but that's what we're best known for. We obviously, fourth, work on opportunities for policy changes, again, making sure that we're solving problems before they even become problems. And then what I'm excited to spend the most amount of time talking about today is working in partnership to address systemic issues. And that's the perfect example of that is through our suspensions and expulsions work. So Minnesota's educational outcome and graduation disparities for students of color are amongst the worst in the nation. Minnesota has substantial suspensions and expulsions disparities for black students, Native American students, and disabled students. Creating alternatives to suspensions and expulsions, now this is when the safety of the schools, the students, and school personnel is not a concern, is really long overdue and essential to reducing the educational achievement gap. We're going to talk a little bit about data today, but this is a problem that we've known that has existed for a very long time. And to be able to like focus in on that and say, what do we actually want to do about this? What are the tools that schools and teachers are hungry and asking for? What tools do they already have that are doing really great work on this and not just letting the problem continue? Those are the conversations we want to be bringing forward. With these rapidly changing demographics, we've got to be solving this problem quickly. And I'm so excited today that we're joined by Superintendent Liam Osorio and Dr. Jenkins, and I hope I'm pronouncing all of your names correctly, who can talk firsthand about the work that's going on, and you'll be hearing from them soon. So in Minnesota, our schools show that students who are indigenous are 10 times more likely to be suspended or expelled than white students. Black students are 8 times more likely to be suspended or expelled. Students of color are 2 times more likely to be suspended or expelled, and students with disabilities are 2 times more likely to be suspended or expelled. This is clearly a problem that we have to address directly. And we are really focusing on solutions. And I think that I want to talk about my vision and the vision that I share in partnership with Commissioner Ricker and the governor's office to be utilizing the strengths and the information on the ground to be making sure that a child can be holistically successful. And so we are focusing more on the solutions than we are on the settlements that happened a couple years ago a couple years ago at this point. So we can talk about that a little bit, but I'm most excited to talk about where we're going, and I think that's the focus, Chair, that you're excited about. So there's two areas that I'd like to mention. So first is the Diversion Committee. It meets quarterly, and that's made up of the 41 schools and charters that are solving the problem that moved quickly into an agreement and are finding teachable moments for non-safety related student behavior issues. They're working with facilitators, they're working in subcommittee groups, they're doing some really powerful work. You're going to hear about some of that today. The second is improving academic outcomes through the Safe and Supportive Schools program. So the School Safety Technical Assistance Center is dedicated to helping schools and committee members develop safe and supportive learning environments. And they've been doing this work in a lot of different ways. You're probably most aware of the work around bullying. and making sure that students that are being bullied can appear in school and not have to face the trauma and harm that's coming with bullying. The School Safety Technical Assistance Center is moving forward, working on this issue of suspensions and expulsions. And we look forward to presenting to you some toolkits and some findings that we're going to be able to develop from the great work of the Diversion Committee and that team in general. Okay, now I know people want to talk about data and where the data comes from and what that looks like. And so let's look at that real quick. In 2017, Minnesota Department of Human Rights reviewed 5 years of the most recent DERS data that had been submitted by every school district. Hold on, I want to make sure I have the right information here in front of me. Yeah, and so schools and charters enter their own information into this DERS system, and it's held by the Minnesota Department of Education. And so Minnesota Department of Human Rights looked at all of that data and was able to pull together this very extensive chart right here. And so I want to look at what this is. So of the 29 DERS categories, 7 were identified as subjective, and that's what we're focusing on when we talk about these suspension and expulsions rates. We're not talking about incidences of violence or knives, for instance. We are not talking about those. We're talking about these subjective moments. So the 7 categories that you can see highlighted here are other, so not even sure quite what that means, verbal abuse, bullying, cyberbullying, threat and intimidation, harassment, and disruptive disorderly conduct and insubordination. And with 29 options right here, you can really see that there's a lot of ways for these to be categorized, and these are the only ones that we're focused on. Of all of the suspensions and expulsions, 37% were classified as disrespect, disorderly conduct, and insubordination. And that's why we focus so much on this subject. If we get a closer look at the 2015-2016 school year, this is statewide data that shows that students of color represent about 31% of the student population, but receive 66% of all suspensions and expulsions. And let's break that down a little bit. African American students, our black students, represent 10% of the student population, but receive 41% of all suspensions and expulsions. Special education. This is just based on race right here, but I have all the information on it. Special education students represent 14% of the student population, but received 43% of all suspensions and expulsions in the 2015-2016 school year, which demonstrates, again, what we already know to be true, that there's a problem with how we are treating some students in Minnesota. And I think it's important to really ground ourselves in the fact that we have rapidly changing demographics. We want our students to be successful. Right now, 42% of students in Minnesota's 7-county metro area identify as students of color. 42% in our metro area here. And so we know we have to be doing things differently for a successful Minnesota. And that impacts all of our students. I've just pulled back up this slide that we started with at the beginning because I really want to make sure we're highlighting the forward nature of this partnership with Minnesota Department of Education and all the superintendents of the district schools and charter schools that are doing this work today. I think we'll hold for any questions.
Thank you, Madam Commissioner. Were there any? I don't think we've started the list yet. Okay, Representative
Wasilek
first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just looking at the table that says the reasons why kids are suspended and expelled, and I'm just wondering if you could clarify for me where sexual harassment or sexual assault would fall. Would those be under the general harassment assault categories, or is that something different?
Chair, Representative, thank you so much for that question. I'm looking at this information. These are the 29 reasons that Minnesota Department of Education puts in for somebody to be. So how the school is assigning those might vary depending on what it is. Is it an assault? Is it a bullying kind of situation? And so I'm not sure how each school delineates that specific one. There isn't a specific category for that, but I'm sure maybe some of the superintendents could follow up and talk to you a little bit more about that.
Thank you.
Hello, Representative. Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick comment, I think. I am amazed from 2011 to 2017 that these numbers are pretty equal. I mean, nothing's changed much. There are a few little bumps in the road in 2012-13. I don't know what was going on there. But, yeah, to me that's amazing that these numbers are, you know, they have not changed, and we've been talking about this for years now. So it's time to really do something, I think. Thank you.
Thank you. Represent any other representatives? Grunhagen. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just a quick question on, you know, on page 9 you have the 29 categories, and on page 10 you have the percentages. Does the percentages listed on 10, are they just for the subjective areas, or are they for all areas?
Yeah.
Commissioner?
Thank you so much for that question, Chair. I want to be really clear, they're just for the green areas, so just for those subjective areas right there. Yeah.
Okay.
Representative.
Yes.
Any other representatives? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we going to hear from the department as well in this presentation?
Representative Erickson, no, we were just going to have Department of Human Rights up here. Did you have a question for them?
Well, to a certain extent, I wanted to know how effective the bullying provision has been that we enacted several years ago, considering, you know, we have defined in statute some specific information relating to numbers 13, 14, 15, and 16, and 18. So I guess I'll withhold until I can talk to the department. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for the commissioner? It doesn't look like any. Thank you so much for your work in this, and we look forward to hearing more from the school districts. I know you've been a really good partner in helping folks move along, and thank you.
Thank you so much for having us. We look forward to reporting back.
And next up, we're going to have the school districts, and the first one I have on the list is Dr. Carlton Jenkins from Robbinsdale School District. Do you want to come? Actually, why don't we just have all three come on down at once? It might make it easier. So we have Sandy Lewandowski from Intermediate 287 and Christine Osorio from North St. Paul. So if you could just state your name for the record before you proceed, you could go in whatever order you would like.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are the folks from Human Rights going to stay around? So if we have questions after we hear from
I'm saying a nod, yes, so. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and other members of the committee. Carlton Jenkins, Superintendent of Robbinsdale Area School, and I am so pleased to have this opportunity to come before you to speak about what the work we're doing around disproportionality in Robbinsdale Area Schools. And I would like to say I'm also very happy to have my colleagues, esteemed colleagues here, who I know are deeply in the work, here with me as well. I think this is a very important conversation that needs to be held in our communities and throughout our states. As was stated by the commissioner, this work is very serious and it impacts all of us in a lot of ways. The Department of Human Rights, we're here to protect all the rights of our citizens. When you look on a national level, Minnesota is too one of those leading states, and we have the resources, we have all the intelligences that we need to have to make things go well for all people to have a quality of life. So having said that, I want to step right into my comments here today regarding our agreement. Once we received the agreement letter, I arrived in Robbinsdale 4 years ago as the superintendent, and when I received the letter identifying why we had been identified as a district regarding the disproportionalities, I looked at it along with our accountability person. I said, wow, I know I got here in August. I'm just receiving this letter. I wonder what took so long, because this data dates back to 2011. And it's been a known fact in terms of the disproportionalities occurring in the country. And here in Robbinsdale, here we sit, where basically our suspensions for white students were at 109, and the students of color were at 700 and 718 roughly at that particular time. So I said, wow, what's causing this? So the work with the department coming down, and we went down and had a meeting and talked about what had happened, but more important, we talked about what could happen. This is a great opportunity, I feel like, for our state, because we know the economic impact of not educating your children of color, your children with special needs, and our indigenous students. This is a serious issue, and it needs serious attention. But in our work, as we began down this road of saying how we're going to begin to resolve it, we have to have serious conversations within our school community with our students, with our staff, and with our staff, meaning teachers and administrators, about what we're going to do, and have a board discussion, which our board, before we did the conciliation agreement, we had a deep discussion on this. It's not new. It's been around, and someone here even mentioned that, said we've been having this discussion since 2011, but now it's time to move beyond the courageous conversations, which I don't do too well, because it's more about courageous action. And so please let's not have no courageous conversations. And I'll lay that out there. But as we get ready to move on this work, we said we have to dig deeper into what are the causes of this situation. Genetically speaking, when two children are born, they're born. Generally, a heart pumping the blood. Generally, they have most of they're born with, you know, if we would say perfect, from a physiological standpoint and a neurological standpoint, then what causes the difference between a child losing instructional time and a child not losing instructional time? Somewhere it gets into our psyche of where we are as a people, how we place value on some children over the other children. And if they were your own two children, we would educate them the same. So we had this hard conversation in our community and said, now what are we going to do about it? So as we began to analyze the data, and we're seeing that truly at the infancy in early childhood, that experience is so critical to how children begin to gain academic prowess. And when they don't, we come to the table with children as early childhood, with even staff having deficits across the country of what that child can and cannot do, and even value on the child that probably needs to be, not probably, it needs to be more of our own lens being reshaped. We have implicit biasness in how we treat a child once we know a child has an IEP. And we said to ourselves, this is not acceptable. Once we see a child coming in and physiologically starting to develop in third grade, an African-American male, there are changes that occur with how we approach the child. So as a district, we embarked upon looking at our student handbook, particularly some of those subjective reasonings behind the suspensions, and had to disaggregate that to see why were there so many disparities between our schools. This is just in Robbinsdale. Why in one school, if a kid does something, he gets suspended for 2 days in the same infraction 5 days in another? Then we went deeper. Is it racialized? Is it based upon an IEP? And we found some real inconsistencies. Now, this was a tough conversation, but the children, when we met with them, they identified the disproportionality. And the best conversation I would go on record in saying was at Sandberg Middle School, where the children were speaking of the disproportionalities, and these were white children identifying how their peers who were of color got suspended and had harsher consequences than they had. And then when we talked to the staff, this is a reality. Now, some people push back. I want you to know this conversation pushes up beyond race and pushes into culture. And we have to say, will our culture allow us to continue to persist in this manner? This is a direct attack on our ability to be the state and the nation that we know we can and should be. So today I come to you to tell you that we're looking at our data now compared to when we started this process, and we see a trend. In some places, most of our places, the data is showing lower suspensions. But this is not only a quantitative conversation, it's a qualitative, because the qualitative piece tells the other story. Data going down doesn't mean that the climate is improving. Some people are nervous, and some people point blank do not want to be identified as someone who has perhaps race consciousness, and point blank being called racist. So is that the issue? And if it is the issue, then let's talk about that. Why do you think more or less of an individual based on that? So we've had some of those conversations and moved to how we calibrate to get a more systemic response to when situations occur. We're agreeing to have conversations without blame. Each one of us have biases that we bring to the table. And we have to become vulnerable and say, yes, we do have this. No, we don't have this. Okay? And that doesn't mean that you are just a bad person. It means that you may have an experience that perhaps you can grow in and I can grow in. As simple as that. We're not perfect in Robbinsdale, but we're pretty proud of the fact that we're having this, taking action steps. We monitor this monthly. We're going to have conversations, data conversations with the administrators and with the various staff leaders. And we're seeing a change in attitude, but we're not there yet. Honestly, this work from the department level, there needs to be a larger department because they're the smallest department down here and trying to monitor this humongous situation. And I can just tell you, you cannot get effective monitoring if you don't have the appropriate resources. This is a mandate without funding. The other part, the last part, and then I'll pass to my colleague, this is tough work. I don't want you to think that this is easy work. In particular, when you have a person of color leading the work of disproportionality, right off the bat, some people put race on the table. Hey, there's nothing about my credentials that says that I am here to just deal with race. I'm an educational leader for 30 years. I think my credentials will speak for themselves. But I tell you this, when people of color leading work, they come up under certain scrutiny that my white colleagues don't. They raise questions that don't embark the community that you're working in to even think about race. They get criticized, teachers of color. We want to recruit teachers of color, but they're up under more scrutiny. And I want this committee to think about that. If we're going to do this work, how can we have a real conversation? We say we want to retain and recruit people to this state, but when you do it, and you're a person of color, you come under scrutiny, and people try to question your credentials. And I guess I'm the best case for that because it's kind of difficult for them to question my body of work. And I'm happy to do it. And I'm not here to keep a job. I'm here to do a job. And I love the community down there, and I love the people that I work with. But I want you to know this is tough work that we're having to do, and I believe that the Department of Human Rights on the right track, but they need more support to be able to go out and have these facilitated discussions in the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jenkins. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Christine Osorio. I'm the superintendent for District 622, North St. Paul, Maplewood, and Oakdale. And I want to thank you for having this hearing and allowing us to bring some of our perspectives to the table this afternoon. I want to honor Dr. Jenkins and his incredible work in Robbinsdale. We've all had an amazing few years together and learning and growing together. You know, as we've had some community-wide conversations right now about disproportionality and suspensions and dismissals, and even with our former Commissioner of Human Rights, Commissioner Lindsay, we've had some really honest conversations about what is it really going to take. The data shows the huge disproportionality that exists, not only in our school systems, not only in our academic systems, obviously in our social and our economic and our housing systems and throughout our entire state. It's not an easy fix. It's, you know, as I told Commissioner Lindsay when he was here, we could stop suspensions right now. We could easily do that, but we have to do much, much more than that. We have to look at the root of the problem. And I thought I would share a couple of stories with you of some things that I've seen in my time. I spent many years, I spent 19 years working in St. Paul schools before I landed in my current job as superintendent in North St. Paul, many years in my roles as a principal and assistant superintendent and academic chief academic officer, we looked at a lot of disproportionality. And something I want to bring up, this idea of recruiting and retaining diverse staff is really an urgent need for us. And it's not an easy one because when staff feel racially isolated into our programs that we hire them to, we have to really support our team members when we do so. One thing that I like to bring up as an example, and we often think about suspensions and dismissals with our teenagers, our high school, middle and high school students. I've seen it at the elementary level. I've seen it at the kindergarten and first grade level. And I want to bring up this issue. We really do have a racial divide between our workforce, our teaching force, and our students of color, as we see so often in our schools. It's just a fact. In Minnesota, we have a lot of white teachers and we have a lot of students of color in our classroom. And for our youngest learners, if you just think about all of our learners that come from diverse homes, different communities, different cultural, religious, racial backgrounds, and they all come into a homeroom together in kindergarten, many times they'll come into a homeroom and the race or culture or religion of their teacher is different than what they come from at home. It's not a good or bad thing. It's just a fact. And many times, students in our youngest environments, they're navigating a world that's just not, it's new to them, right? So communication styles are different. Expectations might be different than the mama they have at home. And right then and there, that divide begins. It's the same thing that happens in the academic world, but the communication divide begins. And that divide begins right at the beginning of an educational career for so many of our learners when they are greeted with teachers that don't look like them and don't come from the same cultural, racial, religious backgrounds than they feel. And that divide begins and becomes quite exacerbated as students grow older. It's a conversation we need to have in our school systems. And it doesn't mean that white teachers need to be bad teachers. They're not. There's wonderful, fabulous teachers. It's about having conversations about race and culture and identity and making sure that we have those conversations at an early age and making sure that we are very culturally aware and we're having conversations about our own biases. As Dr. Jenkins says, we all have them. Let's be aware of them and make sure we're talking about that every day. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that we've been trying to do in our school systems. We believe firmly, and I will say in our recent time, our suspension and dismissal data in our current school year is on track for dramatic reductions right now, as I'm sure you're seeing also in your school districts and my colleagues around me are seeing as well. We're focusing really clearly not on, I've never once ever told my principals, you can't suspend students and you shouldn't suspend students and I don't want you to suspend students and get those numbers down. I've never ever uttered those words. What I have said is, we need to work on relationships. We need to work on restorative practices and supervision. And I'll tell you one thing. I had one of my big high schools last year had not one single fight in a hallway last year. And I'll tell you, part of the key to that was every single adult at every single passing period, every single time, stepped into the hallway. And by the way, it's not easy to get all of our high school teachers to stop what they're doing and step into a hallway. But this principal of mine, even if I was in her hallway as her supervisor, she'd interrupt me and say, ah, bell's ringing, we got to take this conversation to a hallway. And I'll be honest, we had conversations, many conversations with staff who were like, wait a minute, this is my time to prepare for my next class. And it was many, 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 many conversations. But let me tell you, kids don't get into as much trouble when adults are watching. And if everybody moves into every single hallway every single time, a lot less stuff happens in our hallways. So supervision, it's a high energy, takes a lot of time and effort. It does make a difference. Seems like a difficult thing, but it's a simple thing. It's not so simple, but, you know, key efforts like that. The other thing is knowing every student's name in every single classroom and calling students by name when you pass them. It seems simple, but it's not. You know that a lot of our high school and middle school teachers, they see 150 students in a day, and they're busy, and they have a lot on their plate, and it's not easy. Our teachers carry heavy, heavy, heavy workloads, and I honor and respect what they do, but we've really made campaigns to learn the names of everybody as soon, as quickly as possible. We've worked on identity projects as quickly and early in the year so that teachers get to know the identities of their students. And as we know, everyone's different, and even though All African-American students are not the same. All Muslim children are not the same. All white children are not the same. All of our American Indian students are not the same. We need to know everybody as individuals. And we've even done some activities. I've done activities with my principals when they come to a principal meeting. I've recently printed out a staff list, and we did a warm-up activity. Number 17 on your list, how many kids does that teacher have? What do they do after school for fun? Who's their best friend in your building? That same activity, my teachers go back and do it with their teachers in a staff meeting about their students. It's about how well do you know people? How well are you making those relationships? All of those pieces really matter, and they do help prevent suspensions and dismissals because you prevent, once people feel connected, they feel willing to talk when they see problems starting to arise. And it's all about relationship. I'll also say just consistency across our buildings. We've been really working on, we found out as we started looking at our data what one school is suspending for, another school's not doing that. And we're trying to find some overall guidelines. We've put some breaks in place. Nobody gets to do a two-day suspension or more without calling an assistant superintendent for approval. You know, we're making sure that we don't give free liberty for a principal to give multiple-day suspensions without really talking through the rationale for that. Really taking time to make sure that we're looking at academic and engagement, academic rigor and engagement of our students. And when a child is suspended for any reason, we do a lot of work to really dig into all the things that are happening with that student. How do they reconnect with that teacher for whom a relationship might feel broken? How does that teacher make an effort to rebuild a relationship with that student? And also the restorative justice and the restorative circles that are happening between students when they are having a conflict with each other. I'll just say, too, a lot of work with our school counselors. School counselors have a lot on their plate. We're also trying to work to make sure that our school counselors, we're clearing their schedules to make sure they have more time to get to some of our more marginalized learners. A lot of school counselors' time is spent with testing and things that we would like them to have more time to spend with our students who might be less connected to others. We have a goal in each of our high schools. We're not as worried about whether our sports teams make it to state tournaments, although we love when they do. Our goal is every single child in each of our high schools is connected to one activity, after school, club, activity, sport, whatever. We need you to not feel disconnected in our schools. That's our goal. And we keep track of that data point every year, how many of our kiddos are connected to some sport activity. So that's also helping us in our goals. So we're looking at this really holistically. And I'm just going to add one more talking point here. You may have heard a little bit about Reimagine Minnesota. That's a network of school districts across the metropolitan area that have started working together. We've done a whole lot of community meetings where we've had stakeholder community groups, World Cafe, led by student leaders and student representatives across the entire metropolitan area, where we've heard from them about voices and their ideas about how we'll improve our school district, our school districts, and their lived experiences in our schools. And through that process, we put together a whole series of ongoing strategy meetings that we just share ideas among our school districts. We don't bring in a lot of outside consultants. We've just been sharing best practices among ourselves, including how do we change adult behaviors in our school systems. And that's been a really exciting progress. And if you're ever interested in joining any of our strategy sessions, you can certainly look us up and we'll get you connected. So thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Osorio. Superintendent Lewandowski, state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sandy Lewandowski. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate District 287. As an intermediate district, we serve nearly 1,000 of the highest need students in Hennepin County. We're a cooperative for the western suburban area of the metro. Our member districts include Osseo, Robbinsdale, West Tonka, Orono, Wayzata, Edina, St. Louis Park, Eden Prairie, Richfield, Brooklyn Center, and Hopkins. We are indeed a bit different than a K-12 district. Nearly all of our full-time students have severe and persistent mental health conditions. They may be identified as having multiple medical diagnoses and numerous behavioral disorders. Most have experienced complex developmental and racial trauma. In their short lives, they've suffered a great deal, and they deserve our compassion and our best therapeutic treatment possible. Yet often, they're in the classrooms of special education programs in our intermediate districts without access to such treatment. School districts in general have become the front line of the children's mental health systems, and intermediates are often the de facto mental health system for our most seriously impacted youth. To be clear, the schools in my districts have students in acute mental health crises every single day. Often, it's hard for someone to comprehend what those needs look like if you're not familiar with intermediate programming. I want to very briefly describe that reality in my district to provide context to our approach to suspensions. The needs of our students are so intense that they often have completely exhausted the resources of entire teams, schools, and independent districts when they arrive at our intermediate doors. The severity of the mental health and behavioral needs of the students we serve, many as young as six, is beyond anything that even the most specialized education program is often equipped and certainly funded to handle. We provide services every single day to students who are so mentally ill that they make homicidal threats to others, suicide threats to themselves. They experience dissociative episodes of post-traumatic stress disorder, struggle with visual and auditory hallucinations, and indeed, we have cases where they dart in front of traffic in an attempt to take their own lives. Tragically, we find ourselves in the role of the sole service provider for many of those students. Children and adolescents with issues such as I've just described have fallen through the cracks of our collective systems. Their needs have proven too intense and too costly to be met by county-based mental health services, behavior consultants, licensed psychologists, child psychiatrists, day treatment programs, and even residential mental health programs, so they come to school. Yes, we regularly welcome these children into our classrooms in intermediate districts and in K-12 districts. For lack of a more eloquent term, they've been kicked out of these programs because their needs are just too intense. So yes, we are often very challenged, but we welcome our students with all their gifts and their needs. And as the reality of our mission in front of us has become more clear over the last few years, we've adapted our approach, including our approach to suspension and exclusion. I referred to you to the infographic entitled Suspensions in your packet. We've changed our approach significantly over the past 3 to 4 years. Our approach includes trauma-sensitive behavioral practices, decriminalizing student mental health, always trying to bring a clear racial equity lens, clear considerations for suspensions. Examples that are most used in our district are unprovoked assault, extreme violence, or sexual violence. We have a very clear policy in our district that only the superintendent and assistant superintendent have the authority to suspend. Suspensions in our district are not effective in teaching new behaviors and self-regulation, but they do give the adults time to pause and create and improve positive behavior supports and safety plans for students to be more successful. And it's really important to point out in this case, there often is no other time that we can legally access other than a suspension. And we need that to recreate a plan that the adults and the students can work on to improve safety and to improve behavior. What's our data look like? Keeping in mind that we probably serve the upper 1% of the highest need students in the state compared to K-12 districts. We have an average of about 3 suspensions per 100 students enrolled. And that is roughly the half of the state average. And we have breakouts on that infographic. It has certainly been reduced significantly once we implemented the approach that I talked about. But we still could do much, much more. What we need in terms of improving our outcomes is to really embed racially conscious mental health services into our schools. We need to embed ongoing job-embedded professional development for all staff. As my colleagues have eloquently stated, we are learning all the time. And unless we have dedicated time and quality professional development, we are not going to be able to make the changes as fast as we would like and our students need. And then finally, we need to embed trauma-informed practices. We find that almost every one of our students have suffered from trauma of various sorts, and we intend and have planned a session with Dr. Bruce Perry in June, one of the world's leading experts on trauma-informed practices, and we'll be reaching out to the committee to invite some of you to attend that session as well. One of the key pieces of our implementation plan was to move toward removing school resource officers from our buildings. This was an attempt to specifically address destigmatizing mental health and not making it a crime to have a mental health condition. I often say this is our approach. It's customized for an intermediate district, and I'm not making a sweeping generalization about it. But for our district, we felt it was a critically important move to make. We had contracts with about 4 to 5 different police departments around the West Metro area. And I would indicate that we still work closely with those police departments. We, with some degree of frequency, do call 911 and have been successful in working in collaboration with the police departments. But we felt an embedded school resource officer actually led to increasing that pipeline to prison that we're trying very hard to interrupt. Instead, we've implemented a model that we call our school safety coach model. and for the resources we were dedicating and a little bit more, we've been able to double the number of individuals that are in that role compared to school resource officers, and we have about 10 school safety coaches we now utilize in our schools. Their two key goals are to build relationships with students and address behavior before it escalates to needing police interventions. And we've had some fairly significant success with that. Our incidents with police involvement have decreased by half over the 2 years. Schools report fewer arrests, citations, and suspensions, and we believe culture and safety are on the rise. You'll see at the bottom of the back page of that infographic some of the things that our safety coaches are trained in, and those are all key to the approach that we have implemented. But again, relationships are at the heart of it. Restorative practices are at the heart of it. Trauma-informed practices are at the heart of it. And I would say that we, while we have a diverse group of school safety coaches, it is over half individuals of color compared to having all white school resource officers. And I'd be less than honest if I said that isn't a difference and has promoted a change. Those are some of the key things that we've done in an intermediate district to change our practices that would promote the outcomes that we see for our students. We still have a long ways to go, and I would say we need the help of policymakers to continue moving that needle. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Superintendent Lewandowski. Members, do folks have questions? Representative Christensen and then Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I forgot your name from the...
Sandy Lewandowski.
Okay. A question for you. Thank you. So I'm thinking that mental health counselors are very, very important to your program. I'm wondering about a ratio, about your needs, about how they work within your program, if you could just speak to that, or if you have any.
Superintendent Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, members, we have actually a large number of school psychologists, school social workers, behavior specialists, and they provide that first line of support to our students from a mental health standpoint. The needs of our students, however, exceed that ability in that the large majority of our students really need access to clinical mental health services, racially conscious mental health services, trauma-informed practices. And we were fortunate a couple of years ago to be funded for 2 years with an innovative mental health grant, and we're able to achieve that two-year kind of grant, mental health, clinical mental health grant, to secure the Amherst Wilder Foundation with an intensive model for our K-2 students. And that is proving to be very effective. What I have told, what I've testified in previous hearings is I could use 10 of those kind of models to expand across the district.
Thank you. Follow-up, Representative?
No, thank you.
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, is it Ms. Lewandowski, is that, did I say it?
Lewandowski, yes, thank you.
Trust me, no one says my name right around here. real curious, so in, actually this could go for all the testifiers. I'm intrigued about this removal of the police officer from the school, the resource officer. The qualifications of the individual you replace them with, what's the trade, I mean, where do you pull this person from out of this civilian world?
Superintendent Lewandowski?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we posted a very specific kind of job description that really is characterized by some of the trainings that you see on the infographic, including de-escalation, first aid, crisis intervention, and recognition and understanding of mental health. We have a combination of individuals currently in place that were applicants from our own school district who were primarily educational assistants who sought out extra training. We have some former police officers employed in one of those positions. I think where the distinction lies is they're in place every single day building relationships with our students, and they come with that training of trying to destigmatize and decriminalize mental health. We see no future in our kids being ticketed or charged, both from a practical standpoint, but also from the trajectory of trying to interrupt the pipeline to prison. And we feel this is a much more effective model and would see that reaching far into the future. That said, we do have situations where we call 911 and we do have police come to back us up. We do have those kind of situations. And we're closely with those departments, too, to try to explain our model. But we feel this is what's best for an intermediate district in my case.
Thank you, Representative Superintendent Jenkins. You had a follow-up?
Yes, and it actually started with Representative question about the mental health support psychologists. And in the schools, we, because we have intermediates, right, don't have as much support like that in the schools, but that's needed in our schools. And we find our staff now are seeing certain characteristics that we have not been trained for, and they're working very hard, but they may be under-resourced, our school counselors and school social workers and psychologists. But in terms of getting to the second question, and we haven't gone that route of removing our officers, but we are training. And as I often say, officers are just people. And if with the right training, the right resource officers, they too, because from our position and my personal position, I think our students need to understand that officers are people and officers need to behave like people when they come into schools and establish relationships with students. That's a larger society issue, societal issue. But our officers are in the training with us when we're talking about our particular mindsets of interfacing with students. And one of our officers sat next to a student, because we have the students in the room too, and a kid said, I've never sat next to a police officer before. This is an African-American male, and the officer was like, he's white, most of them are, looked at him and said, wow. You know, and they had conversation at the end of our meeting. The student, he shared his experience and that he had never sat next to a police officer. I come up the same way as that kid. I never dealt with police officers until I was an adult. So I totally understood. But that was a moment for the room in terms of how relationships could be built if given the opportunity.
Representative Hewitt, you had a follow-up, it looked like?
No, it went the right way. That's kind of where I was asking, is that we're not going away from this. And I guess to add to that, I would also like to see more officers of color as resource officers also. So maybe you're going to add to that, I hope.
If you don't, and Osorio, you have something to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives. I would like to just add to that. You know, the issue of school resource officers is a really complex one, and it's highly political. We all know that because there's all kinds of opinions in the public about that. It really does come down to, and I'll say as a superintendent, I have three police officers in my schools, and they report to three different police chiefs because we're spread out over three different police chiefs, and I'm in two different counties. So I also deal with two different counties as well. And it really is very different how each police chief, how each police department supports and navigates that. And I will say each officer is... some are wonderful and some are not as highly trained to work with young people. I will say two of my three are African-American women, and it's one of which is a former social worker before she became a police officer, which is fantastic. And yet I've seen over the many years there's some really wonderful school resource officers, and there's some really not so great police officers working in our schools. And so it really does come down to, I think, the issue of whether we should have school resource officers or not. Sometimes it comes down to just the simple cost of school resource officers. And I think the model that we just heard about is one that is a real cost effective model as well. And that's one of the big challenges that we have in our school systems as well, too. So it's definitely a very complex issue.
One more quick follow-up. I've got other people on the list.
I know. I'm sorry. And I would just like to make a statement saying that this is sometimes one of the most positive reactions a student can have with a police officer, like, such as you were sharing. And I would hate to see us break away from that model, but I do understand why. So thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Superintendent Osorio, I salute you for the innovation that you've used in your schools to build relationships and when needed to use restorative justice and other. Certainly knowing the names of students is so important because then you've personalized and they really know that you care about them. But my question is, do you review with staff, all staff, what is in the law in regard to what we've enacted over the years in regard to bullying and harassing and intimidation and hazing? And do you review that all, you know, consistently so that these decisions that are made by staff aren't subjective but based more on what's defined in our statute?
Absolutely. Madam Chair and members of the committee, we absolutely do. In fact, one of the important factors that we have to take into consideration is that, and I love how my colleague it said this as well, sometimes, and back to this point, suspension, while we want to reduce it, it's still something that we want to keep in our toolkit. We dramatically want to reduce it because I think many, many, many times it's not helpful, doesn't help anybody. Occasionally, it is a little break that we sometimes need because when we do separate a couple of students from the school setting for a day, and I like to advocate, it doesn't usually help to do more than that. Sometimes that day is used to reorganize a schedule, to put together a plan, to put together a restorative practice plan, to figure out how we're going to mediate a situation. And yes, we do go over all of those rules. Bullying and harassment and all of those pieces are taken very seriously. And as you all know, you know, bullying situations, and many times, you know, if you've ever been in a school situation, simply sorting out what is a fight or a conflict isn't always bullying. And I know a lot of people like to throw the word bullying around, and I don't want to take it lightly, but a bullying imbalance of power is really something that has to be thoroughly investigated to figure out. And that's something that's really important to investigate carefully because that imbalance of power is dangerous, and it needs to be investigated thoroughly, and it needs to be taken very seriously. And sometimes a bullying situation, we are a public school. Kids have to be able to come to our schools. And as you know, even a school expulsion isn't permanent. You have to have places for kids to go, and we have to figure out those plans. And sometimes a safety plan or an intervention plan requires some really thoughtful scheduling and thoughtful intervention and thoughtful supervision plans. And sometimes those take a little bit of time to figure out, as well as the restorative pieces.
Thank you, Representative Erickson.
So, Madam Chair, just one last. So are you sharing the strategies that you're using with other districts so that you can be a model for what could be done across the state?
Superintendent?
Thank you for the question. We always are. I would say we're not the perfect model, so we definitely love to share, and we learn from each other as well. You know, one of the things, I'll just give an example of things we work on, a bullying situation. We've learned you don't take two people, a child who's being bullied by someone who's the bullier, and say you're going to work it out together and put them in a room together. That's not fair. You don't do that. But you do figure out how can we make this situation better. Many times the child who's doing the bullying also has some things going on with that child. And you put together a plan so that both children feel safe. And sometimes it's a minute-by-minute plan. I start with, do you ride the same bus together? Are you at the bus stop? Every single point in your day, where might you have contact, and how do we supervise, prevent interaction, and make sure nobody has the possibility of this reoccurring, and how do we promise that we're going to make sure we keep children safe? It's labor-intensive, and sometimes it's staff-intensive. I mean, when we call it the wraparound plan, and when we have a child that we need to put a wraparound plan, it includes staffing. Sometimes our behavior intervention and support plans are very labor-intensive, and it doesn't just go with the victim, because the child who maybe is doing the bullying per se may have someone bullying them or harming them. It could be another child. It could be an adult in their life, and that takes a lot of investigation, and it's labor-intensive, but it's so critically important. But to answer your question, absolutely, we're sharing best practices every time we can, and I think that's part of the beauty of the conversations we have with our colleagues, and we talk a lot, and that's part of the beauty of sharing best practices across many. We are sharing best practices of how we recruit and retain diverse staff. Through our Reimagine Minnesota work, we have conversations every month about, let's talk about this strategy this month, and next month we'll talk about a different strategy. And it's it's very complex. Because like I said, you could say let's stop suspensions tomorrow, and we all would, and our data would look beautiful, but I promise you our problems would become overwhelming in our schools if we didn't get to the root of the problems and really try to solve all of the needs that are going on inside of our buildings.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've got Representative Hassan and then Sandel, and I want to make sure we have time for the parents. So Representative Hassan.
Representative Hassan first.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I won't butcher your name, so I'm just going to say the superintendent from 287, District 287. People butcher my name all the time, so I won't try that. Can you speak on the racial makeup of your students, teachers, and administrators?
Madam Chair, members, we have about 60% students of color in our intermediate 287 district, and about 37% of those students of color are black students, about 11% Latino students, and the rest are small percentages of other racial diversities. Our staff population, we have about 900 staff people, about half licensed staff. A little more than half are also non-licensed staff, so paraprofessionals, if you will. We have made great strides over time in our unlicensed staff, and we have not made nearly the progress in our licensed staff. Although, as part of a professional development grant appropriated by the legislature a couple years ago, we have been able to provide for a parent-teacher program for our, particularly for our staff of color, and we have been able to support about 50% of tuition, which is starting to move the needle now on our licensed staff as well. There is no doubt at all that that's a critical piece of what we need to do to improve the outcomes of our students.
Representative Sun, follow up?
Just follow up. And then looking at your data on this sheet, in 2016, you guys are at 1.7. At 2017, 2018, you jumped to 4.4. Can you speak to that?
Superintendent?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we still have two things operating. Each year, we continue to get higher need students in terms of their mental health. And I can tell you that when we have a critical incident involving dysregulated behavior, it can mean multiple students, and we may have to suspend multiple students multiple days in order for us to have that space to replan, reconfigure, sometimes work through the IEP process to transfer students. We also have had two situations in recent years, I don't know if it falls into that particular year, where we actually had to suspend two students the full amount of days allowed under special education law in order to work with outside agencies to find other placements in terms of residential mental health. That changed that year's curve upward. This is not a refined science yet, and the kids who come through our doors really still predict some of this in terms of their needs. We do see more limited mental health placements equaling higher needs in our public schools, higher dysregulated behavior, higher suicidal rates, higher special ed tuition and cross-subsidy rates. So there's a very clear connection, and I'm kind of going off the original point of your question, but there's a lot in this that we could talk about for a long time, and I'll stop there. But it's simply a factor of which students are in our programs which year.
One quick follow-up.
One more follow-up. Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. So if you're serving the student with the highest needs, doesn't suspension disrupt their life? Like, I'm really curious because I know that one of the key things for students with mental health is regularity that they go to school every day, certain times, especially, you know, students with that have higher, you know, mental health needs. So when they come back, let's just say you suspend them the maximum amount. When they come back, don't your teachers start from zero? I'm just curious.
Superintendent?
Madam Chair, members, that's a perfectly appropriate question. I think understanding the level of safety we're also responsible for is a key factor. And sometimes I frankly have to weigh it against the very element that you may have mentioned, and a student being out of school is a significant thing that we consider. But I also am responsible for theirs and other safety and the safety of the staff. And so until we have the opportunity to establish and recreate a safety plan that may indeed, as my colleague indicated, have many, many components in it that have to be put in place in order to bring everybody back together for a safe reconnection, if you will, I'm going to err on the side of keeping that student out until I can be assured we have that complete plan ready to go. And that is simply our reality right now.
All right. And Representative Sandell, if you can keep your question brief, because I want to make sure the parents have time to speak too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple questions about the statistics that were provided by the Department of Human Rights. I wonder what the universe of these statistics are. Is it every school in every district throughout Minnesota?
Maybe we'll have to pull down Assistant Commissioner Lucero. And then this will be our last question before we get to the parents. Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Chair, Representative, yes, this is all of Minnesota.
We should be able to parse out individual schools and individual districts and find out maybe some districts are doing a little bit better than other districts. The statistics show up a real uniformity year to year. Mm-hmm. But if every school and every district has statistics available, we might be able to look here and there and find out characteristics of schools or characteristics of faculty or training of faculty or something which may result in a better situation or better outcomes.
Commissioner Lucero.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you so much for that question. Yes, we actually have the data set for every single school across Minnesota, and so we know exactly what's going on. We also know what's going on at every level, elementary school all the way to high school. And that was part of the conversation that the superintendents talked about, was to see their own data and reflect on, oh, wow, we have different data than I thought we would have. Mm-hmm. And so I do want to be clear, though, that the problems exist across the state, and they range from really severe problems to severe problems. And so there's a lot of work to do everywhere. And where there are some changes, like we're seeing right now, we really want to make sure that we're calling those out so that we can learn from each other.
Well, certainly, Madam Chair, thank you. I don't want to take any more time. But I do, the statistics are certainly concerning and deserve a little bit more breakdown and analysis as well, because we want to do best for all the kids, all the children.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And okay. Commissioner Lucero, when you, and I know that this is newer to you, but the consent agreements for those 43 districts, including charters, mm-hmm. To which you notified they had some issues, to what extent did you allow local control to prevail when they designed their plans? Because I noticed that you prepared two templates, mm-hmm. and I'm just wondering, did those just remain templates, or did you dictate more or less to these districts? Thank you.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you so much for that question. So, yes, local control is paramount to this work that we did here. As you can tell from these from this testimony, it is really a unique situation based on each school. And so there was there's really a lot of opportunity for reflection and figuring out what's right for your school. But our hope was to get people to recognize the problem and start working towards solutions more than it was
to dictate specifics for each. Local control is part of everything we did.
Thank you. And then I want to, Representative Scott, real quickly, I really want to give the parents their 20 minutes. So
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, thank you. I'm just curious, I know that the department is working on this disciplinary stuff. The larger picture is the overall achievement gap, and I'm just wondering if the department is doing any work on that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you so much for that question. These are that's actually a really important question because these two things are intricately linked together. And so we know that when we're solving the problems around suspensions and expulsions, we are also working to solve the problems about the achievement gap as well. There's actually a lot of research that shows that school suspensions account for 20% of the difference in achievement between African Americans and white students. So students at schools with high rates of suspensions exhibit lower achievement, even if they've never been suspended. So if I'm sitting in a classroom and several of my classmates are being suspended, it is impacting my achievement as well. And so we really need to make sure that this is part of the solution as we talk about this achievement gap.
Thank you. And then Representative Scott, you had a quick follow-up. I'm just going to say 20 minutes.
Yeah, Madam Chair. So I just would hope then in a few years that we'll see a huge strides then in the achievement gap based on these new policies on disciplinary actions. Mm.
Representative, there's a lot of other things that go into the opportunity gap that we will need to be tackling too. So parents, I want to make sure you have some time, and I think the first on my list is Andrea Jepson. Ms. Jepson, please state your name for a record and proceed. I'm going to give everybody about 2 minutes because we have 5 parents signed up, and then possibly, or 6?
We'll see how much time we have. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Jepson. I am a parent, but I am also an attorney representing students in expulsion matters. And I will try to go as quickly as I can here. I think, bring a unique perspective here because I understand the law very, very well, and because I am one of very few attorneys who do this kind of work. There are roughly, I'd say there might be 2 in the state that are doing suspension and expulsion work. I'm a for-profit attorney. I'm not here from a nonprofit, and I tell you that because I've taken time away from my practice where I'm not billing to tell you about this very, very serious matter because it is something that is so very important to the work that I do. In fact, we find that because there are so few attorneys practicing in this area, our law firm has to function much like a legal aid organization, and my colleague and I are donating about half of our annual income to pro bono work, which is a very unusual figure. I have testified before this committee before. Some of you may remember my previous testimony that education is a constitutionally protected right. It's protected by the federal constitution. It is protected by the state constitution. We have a property interest. Children have a property interest in their education, not unlike the interest you might have in your home or your car or in your very liberty. And so any legislation that is enacted by this body has to be consistent with the United States Constitution, and the use of suspension and expulsion has to adhere to the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act's requirements as well as the requirements of the state and federal constitution. I think it's very important for me to emphasize today what we are not talking about, and we are not talking about punishment. Schools have a nearly unfettered right to punish students, to correct their behavior using some sort of aversive intervention. What we're talking about is a child's right to his or her education, and children who misbehave typically need more education and not less education. I know you've seen some data. I couldn't see from where I sat, but I think you're aware of the fact that suspensions and expulsions number something like 54,000 individual disciplinary removals last year. What we know about disciplinary removals, and I don't think that there's any challenge to this statement, is that they don't change behavior. They also don't make schools safer. Those children still have a right to an education. Their behavior problems simply get shifted around. Truly dangerous children are oftentimes children with disabilities, and they have their own rights and schools have their own obligations to those students, and I will very briefly talk about that. But whether we're talking about children who are have disabilities or children who do not have disabilities, there is inadequate enforcement of their very powerful rights under the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act, and that's one of the biggest challenges that I think that we are facing where disproportionality is concerned. When we put children out of school, it is well understood that we put them at significant risk. We increase their statistical likelihood of being trafficked. We decrease the likelihood that they will finish a grade. These are not controversial figures. They are well accepted. We increase the statistical likelihood that they will not graduate from high school, and we increase the likelihood that they'll become involved with the juvenile and criminal justice system. It is, in fact, a well-documented first step on the school-to-prison pipeline.
Ms. Jepson?
Yes.
I do want to give parents came to give personal testimony some time. I've already given you 4 minutes. Could you please wrap it up?
I will. It's going to be very challenging for me to help you.
I understand that, Ms. Jepson, but I want to be fair to the other testifiers.
I understand that. I'm going to reference the issue very quickly of school suspension because I heard some very, very well-intentioned, clearly invested superintendents talk about the need to keep suspension in a toolbox. And I bring this up because when there is improper enforcement of children's rights, you have school administrators who come to misunderstand the law. Suspension as a way to create a break for a school to plan is absolutely against the law. It is particularly against the law when you are talking about children with disabilities. You may change the setting where you educate the child. This is true where a child whose behavior doesn't meet the issues laid out in the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act. You may change the educational setting of the child, but you may not suspend the child for behavior consistent with their disabilities. And the last thing I have to say, it's very important for this body to understand that suspension and expulsion, the record of it, if it occurred between 9th and 12th grade, stays with children for a very long time, even a single day's suspension. I have children who are in their 20s. I went through the college application process with them. It is almost always the case that children who are college bound are asked whether they have ever been suspended or expelled, and they face the decision to say yes or no. If they say yes, they're not eligible for certain scholarships.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Jepson. I've got Greg King, Shannon Mitchell. Why don't you both come up together? Mr. King, state your name for the record and proceed. And then Shannon Mitchell, if you'd come up and be ready to testify as well.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chairwoman and committee members for letting me speak. My name is Greg King. I'm a resident of South Minneapolis and through my St. Joan of Arc Parish, a member of Isaiah, who is in the Solutions Not Suspensions Coalition. I have worked the last 6 years with parents creating a dialogue in Minneapolis public schools when they are at wit's end and around suspensions and expulsions. The characteristics of those parents who come to Isaiah are very common. Single mothers with multiple kids of color. Usually they're going to be either a family that speaks English as a second language, or they will have one child who has a diagnosed behavioral or medical condition. Oftentimes both those things are true. What these parents find is that they're in a deep well with no idea of how to get out or what their rights are in that situation when their child is being sent home while they're at work and when they can't make headway with the administration of a school. It's a very unfair imbalance of power, and if there is anything that I could provide the parents that I work with, yes, we need resources. That, you know, I'll come back here when we want to talk about counselors, when we talk about restorative practice training, and if we want to talk about teachers and educators of color. We need those things desperately. So licensure changes or scholarships that increase people who have culturally competent backgrounds, matching that of the students, should be prioritized. But they also have a right to due process. It would be very appropriate, given what we've heard, to be optimistic about what's going on in some school districts with very well-intentioned, well-thought-out, and actually I'm very optimistic hearing what those superintendents are doing. But at the same time, we can't rely on good intentions to carry through, or a couple superheroic superintendents, because they may leave, and that those practices aren't universal. It would be very appropriate for us also to put into legislation and statute limitations on suspensions. We heard some great ideas about how to do that. It would be important to put in the statute the right to due process and to explain explicitly how parents can access that and what the obligations of school districts are if they're going to use exclusionary discipline. Exclusionary discipline is something we should really think about as a very blunt tool that's being wielded very unfairly and is damaging kids today. So resources and legislation to reduce it would be needed.
Thank you, Mr. King. I've got Shannon Mitchell, then Melina Mohaber, and Jules Edwards.
Yes, my name is Shannon Mitchell, and I am the Managing Director of Policy with Educators for Excellence, and I just want to say quickly that our teacher members overwhelmingly support the work to promote alternatives and the work that the Department of Human Rights is doing, and we would ask this body also to consider all of the positive discipline provisions in the governor's bill and the omnibus bill, and I would just like to reserve the rest of my time for parents.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair. Greatly appreciated. Melina Mohaber, I'm sorry, pronounce your name for the record.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and members of this committee. My name is Melina Mohaber. I was here a few weeks ago as a PACER Center advocate working on the Children's Mental Health and Emotional or Behavioral Disorders Project. But today I really want to share how school discipline has impacted my own family. So my youngest son will turn 16 in a couple of weeks. He's a 10th grader this year. And he's really struggled to regulate his emotions and be in control of his behaviors for quite some time. He was first diagnosed with anxiety, depression, and ADHD when he was in third grade. What the doctor explained to me at that time is that anger and frustration are common manifestations of these really common mental health diagnoses, and that ADHD and the impulsivity that comes with it can make it very difficult for him not to act on those emotions, especially when he was younger. So I knew when my son started kindergarten that we were going to have a lot of challenges. The staff at the school were fairly patient, and I really believed that they had his best interest in mind, but his first suspension came in first grade when he was 6 years old. I can't remember why he was suspended. What I do remember is that when I came to the school to pick him up, he was curled under a table with the hood of his sweatshirt pulled over his face. And when I got home with him, he sat on the stairs and he cried and he said, "I'm sorry I'm bad, I don't mean to." So after that, there were multiple suspensions and early dismissals from school every year. Some of them were for serious safety violations, but over half of his behavioral referrals are for insubordination, disruption, defiance, and inappropriate language. There's also several for work refusal. So seventh grade was an especially difficult year for my son, and we decided to try a charter school for a fresh start. That change did help for the first several months, but in February I got an urgent call telling me to get to the school right away. I didn't have any more information. But when I showed up, I was told that the head administrator of the school was sent to his classroom because he was refusing to do work and he was using inappropriate language. So they went out into the hallway. My understanding from both the administrator and my son is that when he asked for time and walked away, the administrator followed him. And somehow all of this escalated to the point where my son was physically restrained and there was a call me to the police. His behavior plan included interventions like taking breaks, to kind of think about what happened and process before talking with adults about that, and to not engage in power struggles over small things. I don't doubt that if this plan had been followed, there never would have been an escalation to that level. So as a reminder, this incident started as work refusal and swearing and ended with physical restraint and a call to law enforcement. So following that incident, my son really struggled more and more. He was less engaged in school. every quarter since. He's done less and less work, and he's failed almost every class for the last 12 months. He's a 10th grader who's not on track to graduate at this point. So in elementary school, he consistently told me that he was sorry he was bad, and today I really just see a lot of hopelessness. So I don't know, you know, necessarily that things would be different for my son if discipline had been handled differently, or if staff had responded to his behaviors differently. But I do know that the outcome for children with emotional or behavioral disorders and other mental health diagnoses are really concerning. Nationally, more than 40% of children with emotional or behavioral disorders don't graduate from high school.
Thank you for sharing your story, Ms. Mobier.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your time.
And I have Jules Edwards and then probably Kelly Cancel, and then the rest will have to submit written testimony because we have to do minutes, and we're already supposed to be out here, but we can squeak in a few more minutes here from parents. So Jules, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Jules Edwards, thank you for having me here today. I'm here as the parent of three disabled Indigenous and Black children. My children are 15, 13, and 5, and today I would like to share my son Mateo's experiences. I brought a picture of him. He's in the eighth grade, and 2 weeks ago I made the decision to homeschool him to protect him from the discrimination he's experienced in Minnesota public schools. There is some graphic content in my testimony, and I've changed the names of other students. In his first 3 years of public school, Mateo had 169 behavioral referrals. They're all printed here. This is by the third grade, many for trivial things like erasing and rewriting his work, rolling around on the floor, or standing on a chair. Since he began attending Heritage Middle School in West St. Paul a year and a half ago, he's been suspended on 5 occasions, plus a couple of secret undocumented in-school suspensions. Our first experience with suspension happened in December of 2017. He was 12. He went on an overnight field trip to Eagle Bluff with his 7th grade class. On the first night of the field trip, I received a call that Mateo put another student's pillow in a toilet and that he would be suspended as soon as he returned to school. I spoke to Mateo and told him to apologize to the other student and offered to give Mateo's pillow to the other student for the duration of the trip. When he returned home, he shared with me what led up to the phone call. There was a non-disabled white student, John, who was harassing and threatening my son and his friends. John ran around the dorms mooning everyone. It was reported to a teacher who told John to stop, and then he returned and told my son to shut up or I'm going to rape you. John called my son the N-word. John physically attacked my son's friend and, in their wording, dry-humped him, and he called it the gay test. John ran around with no clothing, exposing his genitals. John called the Black students ashy and threw a bottle of lotion at one of them. John asked an Asian student, "What happened to my cat?" The teachers in the next room thought the students were just goofing around. Mateo retaliated by putting John's pillow in a toilet. He'd already reported John to a teacher, and then John threatened to rape him if he reported him again, so he didn't know what else to do. I immediately reported the events to the assistant principal at Heritage. I received no response. After 24 hours, I reached out to the superintendent, and only then an investigation occurred. While my son was suspended, the aggressor was attending classes as usual. During the investigation, the aggressor was allowed to remain in school. My concerns were minimized by the school administration. They said that "I'm going to rape you" was an internet joke. During the investigation, they held a meeting for all involved students and parents. The Black children were forced to discuss the embarrassing details that had happened to them publicly, one of whom did not want to speak and was crying. My disabled son did not have the benefit of the doubt. My son did not have an investigation. There was no due process. No one at school defended him. He was just suspended. I am concerned that schools have confused discipline with punishment. Discipline means to teach, not to punish. It is the school's role to educate students, not to punish them. If my son doesn't know how to ask for help in a difficult social situation, and his reaction to abuse and threats is to put a pillow in a toilet, the school should help him learn how to report those incidents, not jump to suspension while protecting the aggressor. I believe that children should face consequences when they misbehave, but those consequences should not be immediate and blind suspension without teaching them how they can do better in the future. Instead, my son was taught the school cared more about a non-disabled white student's pillow than they did about his physical safety and well-being. On another occasion,
Ms. Edwards, I want to give other time, and we have to leave this room in 5 minutes. So
okay.
Thank you for your testimony and for sharing your very personal story.
Thank you.
Ms. Cancel, want to state your name for the record and proceed, please?
Kelly Cosell. My name is Kelly Cosell. I'm a mom to a 10-year-old boy who is in third grade this year. Last year, when he was in second grade, he was dismissed 5 times, and he was suspended 1 time. The time he was suspended, which was May 2018, he was put into a hold. Last year, when I asked what the antecedent was, my child has a medical diagnosis of autism, expressive receptive language delay, anxiety, and ADHD. I did not get an answer about what the antecedent was. The reason I know what an antecedent is because my son has done a lot of medically necessary therapies that were prescribed by his doctor. So he's done 6 years of really intense, like 40-hour-a-week medical side. My wish would be that the medical and the school could come together for the benefit of the child to make them the most independent possibly for adulthood and to learn how to deal in the community. When my child was dismissed, and the reason he was dismissed is because he scratched his special ed teacher, he doesn't know what he doesn't know what suspended means. Last year, I got the vitals, and I don't know if you're familiar with the vitals, but it's in his winter coat or his spring coat, and it says his name, his age, a contact number if he does have to be, if the police do get involved. So at least they have some information about him, like what his diagnosis is. Last Friday, March 22nd, my son was suspended for the first time this year. The antecedent of why he was suspended is because the transportation company was 35 minutes late. So my son was standing in his winter jacket and his winter coat, and he was overheating. When he got to the school, they did get him rice milk because that's part of his IEP, and they calmed him down. Then another child, and they have a partition in this classroom, got escalated. And so when a child escalates, then a whole team of people have to go to that child. Well, my child really likes people. He's a very people person. And so he decided to get attention. He would take the books off the bookshelves, rip the posters off the wall. And when they told him to stop and he just kept escalating, he again scratched his teacher and yelled, "I want my mom, I want my mom." In the case, the principal called me right away, actually texted me because I was down here at an autism task force meeting. They know what the antecedent was. He was still suspended. They told my son that he was suspended. The next sentence was, "Well, does your child even understand suspension?" I'm like, "No, he doesn't understand suspension. He doesn't understand it." My child would be better off completing the day of school with the routine that he knows. The second point I want to make is my child is on Tefra. I do a lot of sacrifice to put my child on Tefra. If your child is on Tefra, and a lot of children are not on Tefra for many different reasons, you, as the school district, a parent can opt to sign a third-party request so that some of the MA dollars can go to public schools to help with funding. I had to ask my school district this year to sign the form. They never asked me. I had to sign them. And I'm very much for public school. I'm very much for let's making sure that our special education dollars and we're helping all of our children. But parents who don't do the medically necessary therapies and only do the educationally necessary therapies, we're putting a lot of pressure on our school districts, a lot of pressure. I feel like I'm a pretty informed parent. A lot of you up here know who I am. I've done everything humanly possible for my son, and my son is still getting suspended and put into a hold by second grade. He's in third grade this year. So I just wanted to share my experience.
Thank you, Ms. Kozel. And unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time for the parents, for members to ask questions, because we have to be out of here by 4:15. So has anybody, one bookkeeping thing I have forgotten to ask, if anybody's had a chance to look at the minutes?
So moved, madam.
Representative Hewitt moves the minutes for the Wednesday, March 20th meeting. Any questions on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, the minutes have been moved. And we 2 minutes here. Do members have any questions for the parents? I just want to thank everybody for coming and sharing your story. I'm sorry it had to be so quick. Please feel free to send your personal testimony to our committee, and we'll make sure it gets to members. And with that, folks, we are adjourned.